Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Caldor Fire is encroaching on South Lake Tahoe. Last night, the wildfire crossed Echo Summit heading east towards Highway 89. The wildfire reached the town of Myers, which is about a 10-minute drive from South Lake Tahoe proper. All of South Lake Tahoe is under mandatory evacuation orders, and evacuation warnings extend across state line into Douglas County. The city is a ghost town, but not before residents endured hours of gridlock heading east to Nevada. The Caldor Fire has grown to more than 190,000 acres and is 16% contained. Overall, more than 53,000 residents in El Dorado County have been evacuated, and some 33,000 homes and structures remain threatened. The conditions are far from favorable. A red flag warning is in place through Wednesday at 11 p.m. Joining us once again with an update on the Caldor Fire is Captain Keith Wade with Sacramento City Fire Department. Captain Wade is assisting Cal Fire. Welcome back to Insight.
Thanks again, Vicki.
Captain Wade, after watching really late into the night, I just went to bed so gravely concerned about what I would wake up to this morning. Can you update us on the overnight progress?
The fire was very active again as we're experiencing those gusty winds during this red flag condition that's going to remain in effect until tomorrow night around 11. Everything is so easily ignitable because of the low humidities, the high heat we've experienced, and these really historic fuel loads in a lot of these areas due to no fire record in some of them. So the vegetation's easily ignitable. As it came down Echo Summit yesterday, we were seeing spot fires everywhere. The firefighters were very challenged, and they did an excellent job of prepping early on. A lot of the structures down in Christmas Valley, as of right now, we haven't heard of any structure damage in there, but we're not through this yet. There's still a lot of winds expected today, and as I mentioned, things are igniting so easily. It's been a challenge for everyone involved.
I mean, that's just great to hear when you're talking about the neighborhood of Christmas Valley, because your heart just sank last night when you're watching those images and just really the grueling work that firefighters are doing to protect those homes. When looking at the fire map, the live fire maps this morning, it appears the wildfire, though crossing Highway 89 towards Pioneer Trail, is it staying largely south of Highway 50 as it advances east?
It is right now, but the whole reason for our priority has been the life safety and the evacuation of that area of all of Tahoe is this fire has proven to be volatile. It has proven to be unpredictable, and it has proven to be an extreme challenge to firefighters who are already taxed dealing with so many fires across the western region of our great nation. So it's nothing is off limits to the Caldor incident right now. And we have a lot of resources coming in. We're just under 4,000 firefighters on site. A whole new incident team is coming into play now. We will be establishing a whole nother separate management and command over in that Tahoe Basin to help utilize resources over there, manage them, allocate them appropriately. And I wanna remind everyone, this fire is still very active on other fronts. The southern portion of this moving into Amador County is still a very active front of this fire, and we're still not buttoned up on the west end. A large footprint, large perimeter, a lot of work for firefighters ahead.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I mean, we're understandably focused on the northeast flank that's encroaching the South Lake Tahoe communities, but I was going to ask, what other flanks are of concern? I mean, in Alpine and Amador counties, the Kirkwood area, Highway 88 near Caples Lake.
Absolutely, that Highway 88 corridor. That fire down there has been very active, and I think some people are losing focus, but your management team and the firefighters are well aware of what's going on down there. We have a lot of assets at risk down in those communities as it moves towards Kirkwood and Amador County, jumping 88 yesterday evening. So we have a lot of resources we're allocating down in there. This is a very challenging incident. As I've mentioned earlier, these steep terrains, the canyons, the drainages, the high winds we've been experiencing, and the super low humidities, all of these have been a recipe for this fire to grow, to challenge the firefighters working to take the fight out.
You're watching live coverage early this morning on our local stations. I mean, there was discussion about the winds being calm, and this was the early morning hours, like around 5 a.m. But given that it's a red flag warning, realistically, is that expected to continue throughout the day?
It is into tomorrow as well. Usually these mornings can be a little bit calm. And as I was driving in from Sacramento this morning, I could see that well-defined column moving vertically up into the air. That tells you that the high pressure is gone, that the winds are available to come, and the oxygen will come down low to the fire, help it to breathe. And as the day moves on and the winds increase, the fire will come alive. So the firefighters are moving out into the line right now that are replacing the ones that have been on shift for 24 hours. And they're prepared. The safety message in the camp this morning was increased situational awareness, head on a swivel as you're out there, no independent action by firefighters, because they know this fire can come at you from all different directions, and it's very active. We hope everyone stays safe, and we appreciate the community's response to the evacuation orders yesterday, as Tahoe residents showed us what a well-informed, motivated community can do as they were patient and got to safety.
Especially, looking at the terrain, we've talked about this. I mean, you've been on now for like the past 3 weeks, but just given the fact that when trees are burning and down branches, and it, there's so many other hazards in addition to just the act of wildfire.
Oh, for sure. Even when a fire comes through and it's still hot and smoldering underneath the ash, there's still trees that have been smoldering for hours, and those trees are going to fall. Those limbs are going to come down. I drove the Highway 50 corridor coming back from a press conference in Tahoe yesterday evening, and I almost couldn't believe what I was seeing. Once again, very active fire coming up over the highway. Boulders were coming down, and at one point the road became impassable after I had passed, thankfully. But it's showing you what an active disaster zone the Highway 50 corridor is right now through there. And we appreciate everyone's patience as they're doing the best they can up there. It's such a challenging area. And this has been a very challenging fight for firefighters.
Especially watching the spot fires, there are so many that are taking place. I mean, can you just talk about the challenge of embers flying past containment lines?
It has just been a tremendous issue. The winds pushing the head of the fire and those ember casts, which is hot smoldering, it can be bark, it can be pieces of vegetation that are small. They shoot out with the wind ahead of the fire. Reports this morning were half a mile up to a mile of ember cast ahead of the fire. So that means allocated resources are out ahead. They're not fighting the head of the fire at their time. They're picking up those spot fires, keeping those from becoming a well-seated or established fire. And then because if that does, it then cuts off the egress for firefighters trying to fight the head. It's a total challenge for everyone involved and has been one of the biggest issues in this incident.
What is the status of aircraft? I know that's been a challenge from one day to the next.
So today we're hopeful that they get up in the air and we can utilize that fight from above. The winds and have, even though they increase, the smoke layers in the basin and other areas are so thick, the visibility for these crews has been not accessible to use these aircraft. So they monitor this minute by minute, and hopefully they can get aircraft on this today, because it's paramount to our success to cut the head off of this fire and start to get a good containment line. We need fixed wing aircraft. We need helicopters available. As of late, they haven't been able to fly. So hopefully today we're going to see a difference.
Finally, just watching the images, it's difficult not to feel like the fire is just going to continue on east into South Lake Tahoe and potentially into state line. But I guess that's the big question. Is that actually the case, given the containment lines? I mean, you were talking about Christmas Valley, and from your vantage point, many of the homes are still standing, which is a testament to the hard work of firefighters.
It is. As I was traveling along 50, I had passed Highway 89 yesterday evening, and I saw those spot fires starting to establish, and it reminded me that this incident is not like others. It's very volatile, this fire, and it's all bets are off on the direction that it's going to go. We can try to predict with some sort of accuracy exactly what might happen, but right now we're focusing our efforts in that area. We're focusing a lot of efforts, too, on that south perimeter of the fire. We just want everyone to keep staying informed, paying attention to those evacuation orders and warnings. If they have to increase, we will do so. And we appreciate the public's support and patience as we move forward, working diligently to contain the incident.
Captain Wade, thanks for spending time with us and providing an update.
Thank you for having me.
That is Captain Keith Wade with Sacramento City Fire Department. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're providing an update on the Caldor Fire encroaching on South Lake Tahoe. Joining us now is CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd. Scott, you worked very late into the night following the wildfire's progression over Echo Summit into one community where Highway 50 meets Highway 89, Christmas Valley. I mean, you really just had a front row view of the grueling work ahead of firefighters. I kept going on your Twitter page to see your nearly hourly, if not half hourly, updates. How are crews managing, given your perspective?
Well, the word, as you said, you know, the word grueling is very fitting. This workout here, both in terms of the terrain and the risks that are out there with the red flag warnings and the fuel loads, the overgrown vegetation in these areas. The risks are tremendous. And so these firefighters have been working very long shifts. They've, a number of them have been shepherded from one fire to another, as we saw last year. And that's just absolutely exhausting. And so, you know, when they're on these fires day after day, it gets very taxing. But there was some optimism yesterday in terms of what we were seeing compared to, you know, how bad it could have gone. There was fire burning down into Christmas Valley on both sides of the valley. And that was a very scary moment. Fortunately, as your earlier guest said, there was no, there isn't any indication yet as of structure damage down there, which is a really good sign. But firefighters, they still have a lot of work ahead of them. And this is still early on in the fight.
Well, just given how quickly and volatile this wildfire is, I mean, amid changing conditions and red flag warnings, I mean, you were really chronicling your evening and you documented some poignant moments, if you could just share one of those.
Sure. You know, something that strikes me when I'm out covering a fire is how the fire can turn everyday moments and sometimes even otherwise enjoyable moments into something very different. And that happened when I was in Christmas Valley and I spotted a house where there were wind chimes. And these were my thoughts as I was passing that house.
Standing here in Christmas Valley, looking at the fire coming down on the east side of it, and I'm struck by these wind chimes, which typically is such a lovely sound, a sound that I associate with being outside and it being serene and relaxing. But it has a different meaning right now. As the wind is coming through, I'm seeing these flames really pick up, really move quickly, much more aggressively towards these homes. And you have hand crews out here, you have engines everywhere, you can probably hear them in the background. And I'm just hoping that this wind doesn't keep picking up and that crews are able to save this line of homes right here, even as the fire gets more intense.
And again, you know, crews were able to do some incredible work to save homes in this area. But feeling that wind coming through, it has a different sort of angry energy as opposed to hearing those wind chimes on, say, a nice summer afternoon in the Tahoe area. And not only that, you know, we were in Christmas Valley where the roads were named Santa Claus Drive and St. Nick Way and Snowflake Drive. And even those names were very surreal to sort of be reporting on, which has sort of a, you know, a certain levity to it. But when there's fire all around, those are two things that are very tough to square.
Well, it's just difficult to see the images, and that's understandable, and not think the worst is going to happen. But you also said that you found some moments of cautious optimism. What were those? What were those silver linings?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there was a spot fire that had jumped across the valley from Highway 50 coming off of Echo Summit. And this created what seemed like a, you know, sort of worst case scenario where the fire was burning down both sides of the valley at the same time. Winds were picking up. There was a red flag warning. I spoke to one firefighter as we were sort of watching the fire coming down on both sides. And he just said, you know, this is just going to back down into the backyards below. And he said, I wish this fire would just give us a fighting chance instead of burning down both sides of this valley simultaneously. But fortunately, you know, the winds took the fire front in a different direction. The fire that did come down into the valley was more of what's called a flank fire, which doesn't burn with as much intensity as the head of the fire. And it actually worked fairly well, at least when I left at 1 a.m, for crews to allow that fire to sort of burn up to the houses, but keep it at bay with hand tools and hoses. And, you know, while it may be an unnerving sight for homeowners to return and see black all the way up to their property, it was actually a good opportunity for crews to allow that fire to extinguish a lot of those fuels, some of which have been overgrown, and still save those homes.
I mean, tens of thousands of residents evacuated the area yesterday. Did you manage to find anyone who stayed behind?
In Christmas Valley, I found all of one person to talk to. I practically, you know, slammed on my brakes when I saw them, because I was just basically at that point covering the movements of the fire. And so seeing someone to speak to, I wanted to get their take. His name was Dr. William Cottrell. He is a semi-retired physician in his 70s. And he's actually written a couple books related to fire just in his spare time. And it's pretty remarkable he was able to find some spare time to write some books on it. He stayed behind despite the evacuation warning. He felt he was in a good place to recognize when he needed to go. Here's part of our conversation.
When you, earlier today, I'm sure you're keeping a close eye on it, when you saw it coming over from Echo Summit and then it spotted on the other side of the valley, what were you thinking?
Well, there's a time you need to hold them and a time you need to fold them, you know. And I was starting to think, this thing's on the run. The car is absolutely stuffed with emergency takeoff stuff. Everything's in here right now, just in case.
Did you think that a fire like this could ever come through here?
Oh, yeah, it was inevitable. You know, the questions regarding forest management are obviously quite controversial. And now we're seeing Mother Nature just say, okay, my turn. You've let it go for 100 years. You haven't tidied the forest floor and you live in the wildland interface. It's coming your way.
You mentioned forest management. The addition to that is often people talk about, you know, home hardening and defensible space. Is that something that you've had to focus on with your home? What kind of stuff have you done?
Well, first, right now there's, you probably have a few drops of water hit you.
Yes.
It's coming off the top of a rainbird up there. Mm-hmm. Everything's saturated right now. You need to know the distance between a torching tree and your house. So, yeah, there's stuff you want to really think about. Hard landscape, you know, that doesn't burn. I feel it's an obligation for you to put it into practice so you don't risk other people's lives.
And so, you know, clearly there, William takes fire and fire risk very seriously. Again, in case you didn't catch it, that sort of ticking in the background was multiple sprinklers actually keeping his home and his neighbor's home damp. Emergency officials, they tell people to leave when there's an evacuation order. This was a mandatory order, so that's important, worth noting that you should really leave when there is an order in place. William was ready to go. He had his stuff packed. But again, he, as some do, decided to stay behind.
You know, I just wonder if Dr. Cottrell slept through the night and if he's still there this morning, just given how active and volatile it is in his neighborhood.
You know, when I left him, he said that him and his dog Sherlock were going to take a nap. They felt comfortable enough to maybe get a couple hours of sleep. And then he said, while the power was off in his home, he did have a little propane stove and he was going to make some coffee and, you know, stay up through the morning and see how the conditions looked.
Finally, Scott, I mean, the unfortunate reality is you've been on InSight multiple times for multiple wildfires, and I've asked you this each and every time. What feels different about this wildfire? I mean, the terrain, just the personality, the characteristics, and the challenges ahead.
Well, yesterday I was driving across Emigrant Gap on 80, Interstate 80, because I couldn't take Highway 50. They closed it to everyone, including media, to get through to Lake Tahoe. And I had this moment where on my left side, there was the Dixie Fire, the second largest fire in state recorded history of all fires. It's over 700,000 acres now. And on my right, there was a plume of smoke from the Caldor Fire, which had just emptied out South Lake Tahoe. These are the only two fires in state history that have burned from one side of the Sierras to the other. And that, to me, crystallized how serious and severe this year's fire season is. You know, as Captain Wade said earlier in the show, you know, there are historic levels of fuel loads, that is overgrown vegetation in these forests, in part because some areas haven't burned in a very long time, and in part because there hasn't been treatment in these areas. There hasn't been mechanical thinning, prescribed burns, and part of that overgrowth is from years and years of fire suppression being the main approach to addressing fires. So I think what we're seeing right now is the worst case scenario of those conditions playing out: drought, climate change, overgrown forests. And there seems to be a reckoning where people are realizing that the best way to get a handle on this is to go in before the fires even start to try to prep our forests so that we're not facing the type of fires that we're seeing right now and not facing them all at the same time.
Yeah, it's almost like the word unprecedented starts losing its meaning. Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and stay safe out there.
Thank you.
That is CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd joining us live from South Lake Tahoe. You can stay updated on the Caldor fire throughout the day following Scott's Twitter page and, of course, capradio.org. Up next, we'll learn more about a new statewide program to provide financial and emotional support to students, families, and schools impacted by wildfires. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. As firefighters work to contain the Caldor Fire in El Dorado County, emergency responders stay behind, of course, but other crucial services come to a halt, including schools. Dozens are currently evacuated due to multiple active wildfires across the state. In response, a new statewide program launched last week to help schools and families get back on their feet during an exceptionally difficult time. The program is called California Kids Fire Relief, which provides financial and emotional support. It's a collaboration between the Small School Districts Association, the California County Superintendent's Educational Services Association, and the Sacramento County Office of Education. Joining us now to explain the program and how you can help is Tim Taylor with the Small School Districts Association and Ed Menansala, who is the El Dorado County Superintendent of Schools. Welcome both to Insight.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Ed, given the Caldor fire is burning in El Dorado County, prompting evacuations for more than 50,000 residents in your county, what do you want families to know?
I think, so first of all, I think the priority here in El Dorado County, we have 7 school districts that are closed, and that's approximately half of the school districts in our county, and their safety is the priority right now. And we know that the firefighters, especially those who, you were just interviewing, are doing a tremendous job to keep safety a priority. We know when the conditions stabilize, our educators are ready to position and provide an education. And as I acknowledge the school districts that are closed, it equates to about 20 schools in El Dorado County. We have a good number of districts that are open in El Dorado County as well. And there's just a sense of resilience and support surrounding all of the families that are being impacted by this.
17 days into this fire, you're talking about resiliency. The situation is dire. And, I can't help but go back to the 2007 Angora fire. The burn scar is in the area of the Caldor fire's path. That reminder of destruction and trauma is real for your community in El Dorado County.
It is. It's significant. And when you speak about the Angora fire, I think what we noticed, especially in these last few days, that Lake Tahoe Unified School District, which nestles obviously in the South Lake Tahoe area, was the last of the 7 school districts to evacuate. And there was a different level of anxiety and concern, and we believe it is a result of the Angora fire. While it was some time past, it really isn't in the memory, the memories of many. I do want to acknowledge one thing, and at Lake Tahoe, South Tahoe High School in particular, during the Angora fire, there is a story of firefighters who actually attended that high school or were a part of that community. And they were on the edge of that specific school fighting the fire because there is a personalization and an ownership, right, to that and pride to that community. And I think that's what's occurring now. When I say that this is a resilient county, I mean that. But the challenges that we're encountering now are incredibly intense. And as a simple reminder, we were just opening up school. We're just in our first month of school coming off, 18 months of COVID. So We've managed through a year and a half. We know that this challenge is intense and we will get through it. But right now, these next 24 hours in particular are very critical, in particular in the South Lake Tahoe.
You hit home on such an important point that the local community is tight-knit. You know, we think about Lake Tahoe as an area for tourism, but there are more than 20,000 people in the city of South Lake Tahoe. These are locals, and given the fact that firefighters are defending, you know, their alma mater, it is not surprising, and it definitely adds a deeper layer of meaning and importance. Tim, I mean, you're with the Small School Districts Association now, but you were formerly the superintendent of Butte County Schools during multiple wildfires, including the Camp Fire, also a small, tight-knit community as well with surrounding communities. What did you learn from that experience that you're applying now?
A couple of things. One, you're absolutely right. I think people that live in small towns, it's part of their soul. I live down here in Sacramento. And I love my house, but I don't think if it was happened to, let's say, be lost, I don't think it would not affect me like it does people who have generations of living in these towns. It really is part of their family. And so that is well stated by you that really, this is really, really a tough one for the locals. And secondly, we did learn, it's definitely with the schools, that the children are traumatized. The campfire only lasted days. You know, we had that thing, you know, about a week into it, most of it was extinguished or just burned the town down. It went a little further north, but it's not like the intensity we're seeing with Dixie Fire on its seventh week and Ed's dealing with his third week. That is a lot for the children and the teachers to take on. That trauma's, while fire is still burning, that adds a lot. So what I learned in the campfire is we can help heal with each other, right? The students writing letters to students helps. Ed getting support from his colleague really helps. And teachers hearing from other teachers, because when one teacher suffers a loss or of a school or housing or this, it affects all teachers in the country. And they really do step up. We see that as very critical to Ed and Ed, like El Dorado and then 21 other counties that are dealing with evacuations. That if kids can write letters to kids from churches, from schools, from wherever, as the kids return, that really helps. And I think the last thing I learned in the campfire is that there are so many heroic first responders and so many heroic teachers that continue to step up. They find their children, even though they're evacuated. They try to do online like assemblies or good mornings just to stay connected. Teachers really in the campfire impressed me as we came back how much they needed. With that said, Vicki, you can't have victims teaching victims. We really work hard when we restart the schools to make sure the teachers have the highest trauma-informed practices. And so that we reach out to Sonoma, Napa, and Butte who've been through this to do that. And then one last thing I just wanted to mention. As this smoke from these fires go into former counties like Butte and Sonoma, the PTSD increases tremendously for teachers and students in those counties. They really, and that the fact that these are lasting 6-7 weeks, they really have to amp up the support for kids that have been through an evacuation. And so it really is a statewide issue. I do think the Calder Fire and the Dixie Fire are top priorities in the country, especially as it heads into South Lake Tahoe. And our association is here to try to help Ed and the schools and teachers and kids as they transition back to school someday.
When it comes to this new statewide program that launched California Kids Fire Relief, what kind of relief is this going to provide, Tim?
Well, our main focus is to if schools, churches can raise any gift cards. It's too hard to send things to people. It gets too convoluted. So we want to have people raise some funds to give to teachers and schools. And then I think more importantly, is my opinion, or as important, is the letters or notes from the children and teachers to teachers. You'll see it, Vicki, as they come back. Well, you'll probably cover it. But when kids read this and put these little letters up, I've got 6 schools in New York that have contacted me that want to write letters to California schools, as we have about 71 districts now that are evacuated. That's just a nice feel. That's the purpose of our relief program, is try to get the teachers some funds to help with their families that are suffering, and then also some letters. And then I think, you know, in Ed's world, he's got his own foundation. And I think that's very important for others, non-school people, to donate to, because he'll put that to good use. And having it in the hands of someone like Ed and our other county soups, it goes directly to the schools. We're not taking anything off the top. It just gets right to the teachers, and that's important. So we're personally delivering these packets. We've already gotten our first load of them for us. And then I think the broader picture for the Insight, people listen from Insight, is to go to Ed's website and look at what you can do for his fire, because I really think they're at the campfire level, is what I told him a couple days ago, and are going to need tremendous support as this moves along.
Ed, as a superintendent in El Dorado County, we're currently talking about the Caldor fire. How will this directly help you, this new statewide program?
With the California Kids Fire Relief Program, we saw the benefit of the program immediately last week. So Superintendent Annette Lane for Pioneer Union School District, unfortunately, one of her communities, Grizzly Flats, was decimated. And as a part of that community, Walt Tyler Elementary School was lost and burned down. And at the kickoff of this California Kids Relief Fund, right, they had an opportunity to present a gift to Superintendent Lane. And when they opened up this gift box, not only did they receive the gift cards, but the personal notes from Cold Springs District from the students and the staff was incredibly touching and supportive. It's difficult to describe what it's like leading a school community like Superintendent Lane, experiencing what she has been. But it is like fresh water, these types of gifts. And it really provides a level of inspiration. And I would go as far as to say, just hope.
I mean, you really just hit that home. School is so much more than education. It's a community. It's a network, especially when you're talking about, you know, small communities like Grizzly Flats. So there obviously is this mental health component to this. You know, Ed, when you're thinking about how to respond to this and how to take care of communities within your county that are going to be going through such a difficult time of rebuilding and trauma, how are you preparing students and staff as they return from being evacuated?
I think that's what we're discussing now. We are benefiting from lessons learned from other counties. You know, I am one of 58 county superintendents. I do not feel alone in this. Tim was a prior county superintendent. Tim had an opportunity to meet with our district superintendents who are currently closed and evacuated, and shared, and going right back to your question, one of the lessons learned from the campfire in Butte County was, while schools or communities repopulated after the evacuation, there's a temptation just to start school immediately. But sometimes even just taking 1 or 2 days to prepare the staff to transition back in can be beneficial. As Tim referenced earlier, it's difficult because they're dealing with a level of trauma. And I'll try to be quick with this example to emphasize that point. You know, when the evacuations occurred and when Grizzly Flats was decimated, we have employees that lived in Grizzly Flats. I was speaking to one educator who described her experience leaving her home at the time of evacuation, filming it, grabbing her most important things, grabbing the ashes of her mother who passed away 30 years ago, and then realized that on the day of her evacuation was the day that she lost her mother. And so she decided to leave the ashes of her mother at the home that was precious to her mother, that if her home was to be burned down, her mother's ashes would be a part of that loss and memory. And that is an example of what these educators are going through while they're trying to take care of others. The last note would be, she referenced just how important the educational institution is for her in being able to identify with a sense of community and also place that she serves. That's what makes all of this experience so profound.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. And just my heart goes out to her. Tim, in the last minute that we have, how can people help? Any final thoughts just to let people know if they want to step up and help?
Yeah, I think if you're a school or church, please go to a youth organization. Go to SSDA, SamSamDogApple.org, and all the information's there. And for the rest of you, I'd go to El Dorado County Office of Ed's Foundation front page, the county office website. And Vicki, I just wanted to kind of end one more thing we need to remember. These children have already been through major trauma with COVID, right? So now you layer this fire, and the support they're going to need is intensified, and double traumas and double crises like this that have lasted since, we're in our third year now. If you think about school year for COVID, that's a different ball game than what we had in the campfire. And, my heart's out to them too, Vicki, I agree. And if we can get some nice donations and letters to teachers, principals, kids, that'd be very helpful. And we really appreciate Insight for having us today. It's a really good interview. Thank you.
Tim and Ed, thank you so much for joining us and spending time with us.
Thank you, Vicki.
Tim Taylor is with the Small School Districts Association, and Ed Manansala is the El Dorado County Superintendent of Schools. They are talking to us about a new statewide program, California Kids Fire Relief, which provides financial and emotional support to students, families, and schools impacted by wildfires. Still ahead, we're going to queue up Gary Vercelli's conversation with two-time Grammy nominee Mindy Hebert about her career as a saxophonist. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez, and we're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Smooth jazz saxophonist Dave Koz and friends, they're coming to Rockland's Quarry Park Amphitheater this weekend as part of their Summer Horns Tour. One of Dave's friends is Grammy nominee Mindy Hebert, who has a dozen of number one hits of her very own. CAP Radio's Gary Vercelli recently spoke with Hebert about a career that includes the work with Duran Duran, the Backstreet Boys, Aerosmith, plus a two-year stint on American Idol. So, when did she know music was in her future?
I basically was born and they took me out of the hospital to a band truck. So I grew up on the road with my dad's band, and it was this, high energy, blue-eyed soul band. And, as a super small kid, I would just watch my dad and these guys in the band. And that's how I grew up. My grandmother was an opera singer, and there was just music everywhere. And I started playing in school band. When we settled down, I was 8 years old. I started playing saxophone because I wanted to have as much fun as I saw my dad having. And I chose right. I've had a blast.
Then you went to the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston. I've always kind of maybe wrongly associated Berklee with like mainstream jazz or straight ahead players, but did you have some smooth jazz colleagues there as well?
The beauty of Berklee College of Music is that you can really dip your toe into everything. And I loved that. Actually, the first school I went to was for a year at University of North Florida. And it was really traditionally jazz oriented. And I learned so much. It was incredible. I was like a rocker girl. I had grown up, listening to Tina Turner and Hart. And boy, I went into college and I was just like, wow, I want to buy every Miles Davis record and every John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley. Then I realized traditional jazz wasn't my calling. I wanted something more pop and more mainstream. And, at Berklee, I could play everything. I would be singing on people's demos at 3 a.m. For a country song. And I would be playing fusion in another room for the next couple hours. And I would be playing funk the next day. And it was so fun. And I think it allowed me to be me. I did start my own band, and it did turn into this, kind of amalgamation of what was around me and what was moving me at the time, which was jazz and pop and rock and soul and blues. And so my music turned into something that was true to, you know, what I was feeling and what I was hearing and thinking.
Read about a lot of great jazz musicians at some point in their life playing in the subways in New York, but you chose the promenade in Santa Monica, so it was a little more upscale street life for you, right?
You know, if you're going to choose your street life, you know, choose it to be warm and sunny. Look, I was, you know, raised in Florida, and I was used to warmth. Then, you know, I went to Boston, and I was just shocked that the world could be that cold. I remember calling home and just saying, I didn't know it could be 40 below zero. You didn't tell me that, you know, what am I doing here? So when I graduated, I moved to Los Angeles because I just thought I want to be warm. So yeah, I literally played on the street on Third Street Promenade and just, I paid my rent like that for a while until Bobby Lyle came by one day and I knew who Bobby was. He was standing there watching me play. And I just thought, oh, he's going to think I'm just the street musician. And he came up and he was just such a gentleman and just said, hey, I'm making a record and I'm going on the road. Would you want to record and go with me? The band is so great. And I, of course, I jumped at it. Are you kidding me? I'm playing on the street.
Mindy, you've had some big hits on the smooth jazz charts. Let's talk about a couple of your tunes that were really successful. Tell us what you did with Imagine, John Lennon's Imagine.
I never thought I was making a record. I was in my friend's living room, and we were just jamming, and we were playing, and we filmed it on an iPhone and put it on YouTube, and here, you know, it has 3.5 million views, which is just crazy. I recorded this in the living room of my friend Arlen, just jamming with friends, and it's become something bigger than us. But it's such a beautiful song, and it's always been a song that's inspired me, so we just put it on The Best of Mindy Hebert, which just came out in April of this year.
How about Pretty Good for a Girl? What do you have to say about that?
I have a lot to say about that. Look, no one told me it was odd for a girl to play the saxophone until it was way too late. And the same thing with being a woman. I really never thought about being a woman versus a man playing anything or doing anything. I was really raised by people that just said, hey, go do or be whatever you want to be. Just work hard at it and you'll be fine. So I had to write this song because, look, I've been in incredible situations and I've seen incredible women take over the world on a daily basis. But every once in a while after a show I play, I'll have someone come up to me and shake my hand and go, wow, you're pretty good for a girl. So I feel like it's kind of my place in the world to change a few misconceptions about maybe what a girl sounds like or the music a girl makes. So I wrote that song kind of tongue-in-cheek, and Randy Jacobs wrote it along with me, my guitar player and partner in crime for many years. He and the guys in the band kind of made it this anthem. People come to my shows now with Pretty Good for a Girl t-shirts and bracelets, and I love it. I love being a voice for women, strong women and capable women. I love having that in the set every night. It's powerful. I'm
I'm just a girl, all sugar and spice. But my daddy said I didn't have to play nice. He said it's not about can't or can. I'm not trying to play just like a man. And I run like a girl, fight like a girl, play like a girl. Damn right, you know, that's for sure. And if there's one thing that I know, I'm pretty tired of hearing,
that's pretty good for a girl.
Mindy, I can't let you go without talking about American Idol. That was a big step for you, probably financially and exposure-wise.
What a cool thing to be a part of this machine. I did two seasons as their featured saxophonist, and I just got to expand my mind and work in someone else's framework and add to someone else's vision. And so it was awesome. And, you know, of course, at the very end of the two seasons, Steven Tyler, you know, is in my ear going, come on, man, you gotta do this with us. Time's running out. You know, we gotta play. And asked me to go on the road with Aerosmith. And, you know, you can't say no to Steven Tyler. So, of course, I took my summer vacation with Aerosmith, and they were good enough to let me do my shows with my band as well. So what a crazy life to go from American Idol to touring with Aerosmith and my band at the same time.
Wow. Do you see any young musicians on the horizon that will follow your footsteps and carry smooth jazz and blues on in the future?
You know what? There are so many talented people coming up the ranks in all styles of music. I look at the band that we've been playing with over the summer. You know, Dave Cause put together the original Summer Horns, which I was a part of 7 years ago, which was myself, Dave Cause, Gerald Albright, and Richard Elliott. And I remember we put together the years that all of us had played the saxophone, and it was staggering. It was something like, you know, 140 years of saxophone playing. This year, he put together another lineup. Myself, Kirk Whalum, Dave Cause, and Vincent Ingala. And Vincent is 29. I mean, he's young, he's cool, he's so stupidly talented. I just watch him, you know, go from guitar to drums, to keyboards, to saxophone, and he just grew up with all of our music and then all of this other music that he was inspired by, like Elvis, and he's put it all in and made it his own. So I'll use him as just a perfect example of a next generation coming up the ranks and so worthy and so cool.
Mindy, I know you're busy, and I thank you for sharing some time with us. Continued success to you, and keep on doing what you're doing, blues, jazz, everything.
I appreciate it. It's fun to make music with my friends this year. It's fun to be back.
Mindy Hebert performs with Dave Cause and Friends this Saturday night at the Quarry Park Amphitheater in Rockland. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. And in the meantime, stay with capradio.org for updates on the Caldor Fire in El Dorado and Amador counties.